hobnob with the Wall Street people.
Well, no, Rubin put the whole thing together. Rubin was our accountant, and he was involved in putting together Intermedia Foundation, and he was Rauschenberg's accountant, but Martha Graham's accountant, Jasper John's accountant.
The artist accountant, as you said.
Yes. And he's no longer with us on this world.
So George gets to meet Rubin, right? And then George becomes the man talking to Rubin and seeming to be in charge of the money that Rubin gets.
We all talked to Rubin, but Rubin introduces us to an investment banker named Teicher. And Teicher puts a deal together with a guy, a little Orthodox Jewish guy in the Wall Street section. He has like a closet, not an office. And he raises the money by going around. He has lots of Orthodox clients, and some are not. And he deals with doormen and buildings and pays them a commission for telling the people who live in the building that there's a really hot new issue that they could invest in. I'm not kidding. I can't remember his name, but, you know, we have his name. And he puts the deal together, and we get $600,000.
Now you have to make something. Now you have to do something with
it. Yes, right. Yeah, so we're putting together a technical, you know, an engineering section to make hardware, and we've got a demonstration room, and we do software, multimedia shows.
Any digital technology? Is digital around at that point? No digital.
No, it's all analog. I mean, depends on what you call digital. I mean, for instance, you might say that a I'm at a loss for language. You know, we made programmers which were stepping switches originally, and then we made programmers that worked on punched paper tape.
Yeah.
You know, that's really digital in the sense that it's step by step.
Yeah.
But, you know, the electronics are, I mean, it's, you know, the digital to analog, analog to digital is pervasive, right? But it's not 0-1 technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which came later. So, not much later.
Right. So what are you making? Are you making the climbs environment, or are you doing something else? I don't know really what you're doing, if it's not
We're doing all kinds of things. We're trying to get... We're working in academics, because I have the appointment, and McClelland is funding some of it. He's also on our board. And after a while, he's the chairman of our board. And we're doing commercial jobs as people. We have a once we get the money, we have a marketing director, you know, and we do all kinds of weird commercial jobs, and we do work for the public television and Boston, but we do a thing like for a big real estate development in Hilton Head Island, Sea Pines Plantation. We do a thing for an underwater explorers society in the Bahamas, multimedia thing. And meanwhile, you know, once in a while, the art world still comes along, we do something there.
Yeah, Malcolm Forbes comes in there
that point. Well, that's, we're going to show it at the Howard Wise Gallery, and he buys, I don't know, I can't remember what year that was.
Okay, to see.
I don't believe that was at Intermedia Systems. I believe that was still at the church.
Right, because it was the experience with him that kind of said, well, let's not lug things around to museums and galleries. Let's do something else. And that's the kind of thinking that led you into Intermedia, moving out of the gallery scene.
No, no, the moving out of the gallery scene didn't have to do with that. It had to do with the fact that everybody wanted new work and nobody wanted to pay for it.
Right, and you wrote an article, The Artist as Schlepper.
Well, somewhere along the point, yeah, but that wasn't connected with the transition from galleries to business.
Okay, so the I don't know if it's Brendel's, you get that designing...
Brendel's, yeah.
Brendel's.
That was USCO.
That's before Intermedia.
Yes.
So, if you can, let's try to connect it here. Are you in Boston in your office when Nixon's president? Can you put those two together?
No.
let's try to see. 69 is Nixon's president. It's definitely a couple of years after Life magazine. You're on the cover and in Life magazine.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you've got the right years. All you asked the question, can I do it? You can do it. I don't know. It's not in my memory bank.
Yeah, it's going through the Bancroft history. It's hard to determine when Intermedia started, the year.
Well, we know exactly when it started because I have a copy of the check.
Okay, has Warhol been shot? Can you put that?
No, I'm terrible about dates. You know,
or making associations. You know, external associations, news events. You don't think that way. You don't put those two together. All right. Does Intermedia? I know you're up in. You do Venezuela with Intermedia up as late as 76, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
And you say that you taught at Santa Cruz. After
I was at Intermedia. No, I didn't say I was at.
Oh, it was during Intermedia.
I was. What do you call it? Commuting.
Okay, so let's. And Paul Lee.
I commuted to Santa Cruz, and I commuted to Venezuela.
See, Paul Lee is so important in your life. he makes the introduction.
You're the one who's making him important.
Well, I'm just showing the pattern that Paul Lee.
Yeah, there's a pattern. That's right. Paul, Richard Baker, Reb Zalman. You know, we can point to a lot of people.
Right, with Paul Lee, though, you can connect to the Millbrook connection. I think he, and then the MIT connection, and then the.
No. Wait a minute. Paul Lee was not the connection
to Millbrook.
He is connected to Millbrook, but he wasn't our connection to Millbrook. Gunther Weil was the connection.
Ah, now Gunther Weil. We have his website here. I looked him up. Do you know what happened to him? Are you up on? Have you kept in touch with him?
No.
Okay. So what's interesting about him is that he becomes like an S guy, a forum guy. He's not part of that, but he does that kind of stuff.
That's right. He does lectures, right?
Yeah.
And he did them with his ex-wife, his second ex-wife who died.
Yeah, now I'm just going to read you his site because I saw him speak in Montreal in 1968, and he was in the Gurdjieff at that point. And he had left the Richard Alpert, Leary, Metzner world. He was part of that gang in some way.
He was teaching at Brandeis.
Ah, okay. So he would know Paul Lee?
Yes.
Yeah. It says he's an organizational consultant. This is his own company's website. Executive coach, educator, and psychologist. For the past 35 years, he has provided wise and expert guidance and support to senior executives, family businesses, and for-profit and non-profit organizations in the areas of values-based leadership and organizational culture, innovation, team-building, strategic planning, conflict, conflict resolution, and executive wellness. And he,
so what?
Well, he actually does quite well in that kind of...
Maybe not.
Now, here's what they say in the description of him, his bio in his company webpage. Early in his career, Gunther Weil served as CEO for 10 years at Intermedia Recording Corporation.
That's right.
And was senior vice president of Intermedia Systems Corporation.
There wasn't any senior in either of them, but if he wants to be a senior, he's welcome.
And Intermedia Systems is described as a pioneering, publicly held multimedia production firm.
That's true.
His numerous music publishing, producer, and executive producer credits include the 1978 hit recording Jet Airliner, which received both gold and platinum status for sales exceeding 2 million, as well as the 2001 release of the CD New Train by the critically acclaimed artist Paul Pena. Now, did he take over your sound, the Intermedia Systems sound studio?
No, he, what do you mean take over? The Intermedia Recording or Intermedia Sound was part of Intermedia Systems Corporation. We bought the studio when it went bankrupt. I mean, General Electric gave us a very good deal through our banker.
Right, and I'm thinking about...
And wait a minute. Gunther became the manager of the studio. And he was a vice president of Intermedia Systems Corporation.
Is there a reason why he was manager of sound? Did he have a musical background? Or that's just where he got slotted in?
He slotted in.
Right, because he capitalized on that. In a sense, I'm assuming when Intermedia goes kaput and you sell off the studio and...
He's gone. He's long gone. He took a job as a professor at Massachusetts, UMass, when they built the new campus.
Right.
JFK.
Right.
Yeah. And he left us in a rather sudden and unprincipled way, and he took a lot of property with him, which he had no right to take, but which we didn't quite understand for some time.
Right, and so he learned a lot about music studios because he was able to get producer credits for a hit recording in 1978, so he cashed in.
We had the only 16-track studio, the first 16-track studio in the world, and he didn't know diddly shit, and we had some very good engineers, but sure, he was a producer. What does that mean?
Yeah, executive producer.
Wait a minute. That means that he spec'd the studio time. In other words, we were investing in those people, and they didn't pay us until they sold their music. Okay? And then he wound up with a percentage of their royalties personally, which was definitely a huge conflict of interest, and management contracts. Okay?
Yeah. That's the advantage of being executive producer.
That's the advantage of being not straight.
Right. Now, interesting.
I knew his father. His father was a very reputable professor of psychology. Refugee, University of Wisconsin.
It says in this history, we mentioned Abraham Maslow earlier, Gunther names his professional mentors are Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow, the father of humanistic psychology. In 1965, Gunther was invited by Maslow to teach at Brandeis University.
That's right. He had been a student of Abe's.
Right, and it says he subsequently received faculty and administrative appointments at Boston College and the University of Massachusetts-Boston.
Right.
He also conducted personal growth seminars in leadership, creativity, emotional intelligence, and wellness for executives. He was a 30-year...
Okay, I don't need to hear anymore about Gunther.
No, let me just give you the last sentence.
Well, who cares? Ask me a question about Gunther. I don't want to hear about his, Frisch Lugana... history of co-option.
Okay.
This is me off, as you will have noticed.
Yes. Just for the listener, bear with me. This is not for you. We've heard of, I don't watch Oprah Winfrey, but I've heard that she promotes this New Age guru, Eckhart Tolle, T-O-L-L-E.
That's right. She does.
Well, he was, Gunther is involved with Eckhart Tolle.
He'd be involved with anybody who he thinks he can make money with.
Yeah, who's happening? He's a master trainer of neuralistic programming.
Oh, come on, give me a break, baby. You know, well, we don't need to talk about this.
But he's the one who introduced you to, the reason we brought him up, he introduced you to, I thought it was Paul Lieb. Oh, Millbrook?
No. No, I met him at Millbrook.
You met Gunther Weil, right.
Under a waterfall.
I'm trying to show that, or I've noticed that Paul Lee connects with a lot of the different...
Do you have a glass of water, honey? Huh? What about Paul?
That he connects with a lot of the important transitions in your life. Now, the intermedia, when you say you do a lot of... Is the climbs, making the climbs for the classes, that's an intermedia... software programming project?
The climates you're talking about?
Yeah, the moods in the classrooms.
Yeah.
That's one of the...
Classroom climates, yes. That's an intermediate systems project, yes.
Okay, can you give me another kind of project? Because one of the things in McLuhan terms is...
I just did. I told you about the sea pine thing. I told you about the Underwater Explorers Society.
Well, I was wondering what you did for them. Would you create environments?
Yeah, multimedia environments.
And how would the Underwater Society use that?
It was an experience. A four-wall slide and sound experience of people being underwater and with the fish and with the tanks and some of the training. So it was an experience, about a 30-minute program.
An early virtual reality experience. They'd get the simulation of being under the water through your environment.
Right, exactly.
And so that is, can we categorize that as the kind of things you did in different contexts? Simulated environments for people who couldn't get to the actual environment.
Well, also people who wanted to sell things. The Underwater Explorer Society wanted customers to take their training and their tours. Sea Pines Plantation wanted to sell land and houses.
Yeah, it's a kind of doing an ad, but you put the person inside the ad.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So how many years did Intermedia go? Am I right to say Venezuela peaks in 76? Is that right in my mind?
Probably.
Yeah, you're talking 7-8 years of Intermedia.
Yep.
Yeah. So in this period, Sally Shaw, she doesn't marry you right away. Eventually, she marries you. And at that marriage, Paul Lee creates a faux pas. you had, who was it, Richard Baker does the marriage ceremony, right?
Right.
At the Green Gulch?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are those? Are these like retreat centers that Roshi Baker created?
Green Gulch is a Zen farm on the slopes of Mount Tamalpais.
And then there was the Zen Center in San Francisco, and then there was a third one in between. I think you named three of them. Three things
well,
he built.
Tassajara.
Right, and that was another?
Carmel Valley.
Was it a farm?
Tassajara? No, it's a retreat center.
Okay, so at the one with the farm, Green Gulch, is when you marry... How many years are you with Sally before she marries you? Is it three?
At least, maybe more.
At the ceremony, Zalman Schachter, Rabbi Schachter, comes to it. He says a few words, but Paul Lee gets up... almost uninvited. He's expected to say a few words, but not to go on. And he does the Protestant marriage ceremony, which bothers Sally, because in that ceremony you have to love and obey your husband or something like that. There's a phrase like that, right?
Right.
And you politely ignore that he did that, but that's the only faux pas I've noticed that Paul E. made in your life.
Well, he got angry at us because we didn't send him a painting that we had promised him. And he also was angry at me because when he got me the job at...
Santa Cruz,
he wanted me to do a multimedia production of The Myth of Error. He still wants me to do it. And the problem was, while I was there, he wanted me to do it, and I wanted us to do it, and he wasn't willing to do the work.
So again, you had to find the money, and there was no money.
No, I didn't do it.
Yeah, you didn't do it.
The Myth of Error was never done.
Myth of Error, most people know, is the Plato's cave.
Right.
So, is that maybe the last time you connected with Paul Lee? I mean, or he disappeared after that in your life?
No, I mean, just a few years ago, Paul and I were together with Richard Baker at Crestone. I've seen Paul probably 3 or 4 times in the last decade in Santa Cruz. My son, Abram, was going to Santa Cruz, and he still lives near Santa Cruz, and so does Paul, so I usually see him.
Did you lose contact? See, in 96, you've lost contact with him. You reconnect, you know, over the last 10 years, but was there a period from the 70s to the 90s where you lose contact with him after Santa Cruz?
I wouldn't say altogether lost contact, but we didn't see very much of each other. When he came to New York, once in a while I'd see him, and he did come to New York.
And what was the painting? What was the painting he wanted?
It was a copy of the Shiva painting, the big painting.
Right.
I can't remember the details. We were making copies of it, and he was supposed to get one. He paid us for it. There was some screw-up. Either it didn't arrive, or I don't know.
Right.
Michael may remember. He felt we owed him money, but he no longer feels that way.
Right, but that happened before he got up and intervened in the marriage ceremony. The painting.
No. I mean, you mean the fact that we did the painting? Yes, it did.
Yeah, you were saying he was a little
long, thief. Long before, right? It was during USCO.
And you think maybe that is why he irritated you?
No. He's a Protestant minister.
And he thought you should hear those words.
No, he mostly thought Sally should hear those words, because it was her scene.
Would he become sympathetic to the feminist movement? You know, Sally's expressing a feminist idea of the not wanting those words in the ceremony.
Well, it wasn't just that. She didn't want to be taken back to her upbringing.
Oh, yeah, the Protestant upbringing.
Right.
How did...
She didn't want her parents to come.
Had she converted?
West.
And she had converted to Judaism at that point?
No.
But she did, and was that...
After we had Abram, and Abram was, I think, around 4 or 5.
And was that partly under the influence of Rabbi Schachter?
Yes, except he tried to dissuade her from doing it because he didn't like people to give up anything, but she kind of insisted, and then he insisted that we get remarried.
After you got divorced, you mean?
No, after she converted, because
all remarried again.
In a Jewish ceremony, because then now she was Jewish.
And the what was the ceremony under Rosie Baker? Was that Buddhist? Zen?
Yes, that was a Zen. That was a Zen.
Zen ceremony, yeah. It reminds me somewhere, it might be in the Bancroft history, but the distribution, no, I'm mixing up with some of us. You had nothing to do with the distribution of the hookahs for smoking marijuana.
Certainly
the
not.
Water pipes.
No.
Yeah, no, I thought that.
Or any other paraphernalia.
Right. I'm mixing up with a guy who started New York Rocker magazine. But the other day I was trying to remember, where did I hear that story? And I thought it was you, but I couldn't find it in the Bancroft history. Okay, so the work for Intermedia was lucrative for a while, right?
Well, I mean, it was, yeah, I mean, but we had as many as 30 people working for a while, but, I mean, it always was very hard, and George was terrible about money. He bought 50% of that underwater society, Explorers Society in the Bahamas, which was definitely a serious loss. There were other financial problems, and we were trying to sell both hardware and production. It kind of survived for, like you say, 7 or 8, maybe even 9 or 10 years, and finally we went Chapter 11, and I had to kind of work a year and a half to get the company at least all the obligations taken care of with a staff of only 2 people by that time, and a much smaller office. And everybody else was gone. George was long gone. And then I became president, reluctantly.
But you kept the integrity and paid off your obligations to people or performed.
No, we couldn't pay them off. We paid, you know, cents on the dollar. But people accepted it. But, you know, when you're bankrupt, you're bankrupt.
And if you hadn't done that, they wouldn't have got it, and George and them didn't care.
George and them were gone. Long gone. Years gone.
Yet they caused the problems. Or he did.
Well, in a sense. I mean, you can... Businesses are businesses. They're not problems.
But you did carry on after him. And
yes,
and
I did. And well, I carried on for some years after him, and some of the years were very good. What really sunk us was more Gunther and Tony Cherubini, who was a filmmaker and who made a deal to do football training films with the Hartford coach. And that was a total disaster, and a 3-screen film he was supposed to do about the for the Museum of the China Trade was another disaster. So there was some real problems, and Venezuela wound up a problem because the last projects we did for them, they never paid for them.
Yeah, because the government changed.
Yes.
But before we get into that period, I want to go back. Is it while you're at Intermedia that you meet Huey Newton, the Black Panther? I mean, it's through Bert Schneider and Head, making the movie Head, that you meet, because he gets involved with the Black Panthers. So it has to be after the Head movie, and Intermedia does not do Head, right?
You mean Give Head?
Yeah. Intermedia does not give Head. Usco gives Head.
That's right. So I met Huey through Bert, and could very well have been after Intermediate got started. I knew him long before I was at Santa Cruz.
Where you got Huey in to be a student.
Eventually.
Yeah.
With Paul.
Yeah, Lee. Paul Lee. And Santa Cruz is like the early 70s or something. So you knew Huey before. So we can assume this is in the Black Panther peak period, which is 69. They start getting beat up in about 70, 69, 70. Remember, Fred Hampton is killed in Chicago in the fall of 69. Do you remember that?
I just edited some hours of Huey audio tapes, including all of that history.
And talk about Fred Hampton and the turnaround.
Fred, yes.
So that's...
Bobby Seale. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so then you got...
Bobby Seale and Huey started the party.
Yeah, about 1965, 66, somewhere around like that, right? I mean, I could Google it, probably check it, but it is... it's before 67, I know that. So you... Go ahead.
No, I'm not going ahead. So what do you want to know about Huey?
Well, how did you meet him? What was your first encounters with him?
I don't know. I met him with Bert. And I don't remember whether it was in Oakland or in Los Angeles.
Was Candace Bergen there?
She was around, yes. I mean, we all were together at one time, but I'm not sure it was the first time.
So you know this guy David Horowitz, who was an editor at Ramparts magazine. Have you heard of him, David Horowitz?
I've heard of him, but I'm not sure I knew him.
Right. Well, he got involved with the Panthers in the early 70s, and he now, well, he's been for since the 80s, an apologist for the right wing, exposing the dirty history of the radical students and the Black Panthers and how they were involved in murders in San Francisco. That's what he writes about, and he has his own right-wing publishing outlet and website. Did you ever hear about that crisis around you and Newton?
No.
So probably you're talking to Huey Newton before then, I guess.
Before
73, 74.
Okay.
So in these...
Absolutely, because the 8 hours of recording I did of him was in 72.
And that is, you've known him for a while?
Yes,
you've known him for a while. And is he a student at that time?
Yes.
All right, then we know that's when you're at Santa Cruz, 72, right? Were they done around the time you were at Santa Cruz? Were you teaching, you know, in 72, and he was there, and that was the opportunity, him as a student, where he had time to talk about his history, right?
No, he didn't go to Santa Cruz until a couple of years after I was no longer there.
All right, so...
Or maybe a year after, maybe. But I knew him. When I interviewed him, it was in Oakland at his apartment.
Can you think of yourself as being a teacher at Santa Cruz at that same time?
Not necessarily.
Hmm. But you are going to help him get into the school, so this is definitely before 74. You know, we can say that. They happened in 72, and maybe you've been teaching at least in 70, 71. So that gives us...
I taught 2 years.
Right, so it's 70, 71, 72, something like that. It says here the Black Panthers formed by Newton and Bobby Seale on October 15, 1966. So did you do
anything? I didn't know him
then. Right. Did you, when you were with him and talking to him, were the Black Panthers, you probably discuss it, were collapsed, basically? The Black Panther Party is gone when you're interviewing
him? No. I mean, but it wasn't gone, but it was not at its heyday.
Right.
And, you know, he used to come to
sympathetic to the Black Panther program, or you were just interested in Huey as a person?
Sympathetic, undoubtedly. Huey was a friend of mine.
Right, but did you agree?
I mean, sympathetic to the party. I mean, I was sympathetic to anything that was in the direction of equality and non-racism, for sure.
Right, according to the...
It doesn't matter whether, it had to do with Huey or Maya or not anybody personally, but, I certainly have always had a positive relationship with minorities of all kinds.
It says here... in the Wikipedia, which may not be accurate, but it says the group's political goals, the Black Panthers' political goals, were often overshadowed by their confrontational and militant tactics and by their suspicions of law enforcement agents. And we know the law enforcement guys meddled in there, put false information within the groups. It says that the Black Panthers considered them as oppressors to be overcome by a willingness to take up armed self-defense. After,
I mean, it was dialectical materialism.
Right.
And it was philosophical more than militaristic, but the arms were legal. They were not illegal arms.
They were legal.
At least they were legal. They were symbols more than of course, they did have run-ins with the police, and people got shot.
Yeah.
And the violence was terrible, and Huey had a violent streak, which, of course, I didn't like, and when he was in that kind of thing, I just couldn't take it. I didn't know him the last years of his life. They were very bad years, drugs and violence. He got murdered.
Yeah. It says here, after party membership started to decline during Huey Newton's 1968 manslaughter trial, the Black Panther Party collapsed in the early 70s. Did you discuss his manslaughter trial in your interviews with him?
Yes.
Yeah.
He did.
Right. And then the last sentence in the entry, it says, writers such as Black Panther and socialist Angela Davis, an American writer and political activist, Ward Churchill, have alleged that law enforcement officials went to great lengths to discredit and destroy the organization, including assassination. That would be like Fred Hampton, one example.
Yeah, it's true.
So Huey Newton, he died almost 20 years ago, 1989.
Right.
Did you go to the funeral? Or were you out of touch?
No.
So what can you tell us about the Bert Schneider, Bob Rafelson scene after making the hit? Is there any anecdotes about that? Because he did become a funder of a lot of Bert Schneider funded a lot of activist groups. I don't know if people knew that.
Yeah, well, he certainly funded the Panthers.
Yeah.
I stayed very tight with Bert for years, and then because of his cocaine use and his misogyny, I just didn't. But we're back in touch now, and in fact, I'm going to go see him in October.
Yeah, we mentioned that in the last session. So I'm going to look at my notes here and see a couple of points that... what's interesting is that you knew Rip Torn and worked with Rip Torn, and you did the beard. You did the environment for the beard, theatrical environment, for Michael McClure's The Beard.
Yep.
Now, that was Esco, before Intermedia?
I think it was kind of in the...
the transition.
Yeah, in the transition stage.
Yeah. Because what's interesting about Rip Torn, are you familiar
And later on we worked with him on Deer Park with Norman Mailer.
Right, and I...
But that was Intermediate.
That was Intermediate, right.
Yes.
Now, I saw Norman Mailer at Dalhousie University in Halifax, 69-70, in that period, and he was showing Maidstone. And in that movie, remember, Rip Torn attacks him in the movie. Like, they're doing... Have you seen Maidstone, where Mailer plays a character running for president?
I don't remember ever seeing it, but I may have.
Well, they were like... It was sort of real. I don't know what cinema reality. It was sort of real, but fictional. So at one point, Rip Torn, either because he was personally angry at Mailer, or he thought that's the next stage, this dramatic way of making a movie would happen, he literally attacks Mailer with a hammer or something. And, of course, they fight, and I think Mailer bites Rip Torn's ear, and Mailer's wife is there, and they're doing it in front of the kids. It's total panic. And the movie kind of ends with that scene, this violent, real breakout. I was wondering if Rip Torn ever discussed that with you. Did you ever hear his take on his battle with Mailer at that time?
Certainly not.
You're not familiar with
that? Norman and Rip and I worked together on the other project much after that.
Yeah, Deer Park. I mean, let's look that up. When was that made as a movie?
No, this was not a movie. This was a play.
Oh, the novel was turned into a theater piece.
Yeah.
And so Rip Torn was part of that. He and Mailer would have...
He was the director.
And did that get produced?
Yes.
And I think I remember there was some...
We made some pieces of for the gambling scene, light boxes.
Right. Now, was it the beard or Deer Park that got accidentally or screwed up by the reviewer? So it had a short run.
That was the beard.
And would that be about, that'd be 67, 68. So if that had got a longer run, you might have had more gigs in theater.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, who knows?
What do you say?
The avant-garde is the avant-garde.
Right. It's just that you were disappointed that it didn't have as long runs, reading the Banford interview, and it seemed that you...
I don't remember that, but whatever. It was a very nice piece of work, but at the Evergreen Theater, and the review said that the media was either the best part or was great. They didn't say that much about the acting or the directing, and Michael and Rip, particularly Michael, was very unhappy.
Yeah, Michael McClure, right?
Yes. We've never been friends since.
But it was the reviewer's opinion, not
you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but anyway, but Rip has, especially since Geraldine died, he got even more paranoid than he ever has been. I've never seen him since.
And that's many years ago? I don't know who Geraldine...
Yeah, quite a lot of years ago. I mean, he lent us his place in Mexico after the beard. So, but who knows?
Did you say rented or went to this place?
He lent us.
Lent?
Yeah.
And is that in the 70s?
Yeah.
Now, who's Alan Douglas? You have a section on Alan Douglas. The name sounds familiar to me. I thought it was the guy who created the ESP Records, but that was someone else. So is there a reason?
Douglas was a record producer and other projects and media. He recorded. He bought the Tim Leary album from us, and he recorded the Lost Poets. He had Jimi Hendrix last I think he's still alive. He's a very unscrupulous being.
Right. That's what it says here in Wikipedia. It says he's an American record producer who has worked with Jimi Hendrix, Miles Davis, Lenny Bruce, and the Last Poets. He runs his own record label, Douglas Records. So, Douglas Records, is that still going?
I don't think so. I mean, we sued Douglas Records, and we won the suit. And he explained to us that the company didn't exist.
This is a article. There's a picture of him. Let's see. The magazine The Wire did a story on him in July 1997. And it talks about he worked with many of the Century's underground greats, Lenny Bruce, Tim Leary, The Last Poets, Eric Dolphy, Miles Davis, and most...
He cheated practically all of them.
Yeah, it says, and most controversial of all, Jimi Hendrix. So he's someone that we don't need to... What was the reason he comes into your life? Mouse Studios?
I think Gunther introduced us to him.
Now, I have here any stories about Ted Sizer, S-I-Z-E-R.
I don't know. Ted Sizer was the head of the Graduate School of Education at Harvard, and I was attached to that school. He was always very nice to me, unlike most of the faculty.
Yeah, now, how long did you do that gig at Harvard as an associate educator? Was that a year or...
Two years. 2 or 3.
So what was it like having students? Did you have the teaching ability? Could you handle the bureaucracy?
No, I couldn't handle the politics of the bureaucracy. The students were fine. And see, it was in the B school as well as the School of Education. That was through Litwin and McClellan. It's too complex. There were too many relationships, and it was unpleasant.
Right. You say the B school, you mean the business school.
Oh, yes.
Business and education. Now, when you taught later at Santa Cruz, you did the history of consciousness via technology, or the technological aspect of the history of consciousness, and you used a lot of McLuhan. Did you use McLuhan earlier in the Harvard school?
No. No, I didn't teach. I taught media production. I didn't teach theory.
So you showed him how to do work with equipment?
Yep. And how to put together... We were putting together what basically case histories in media form instead of written form.
Right. Does the name Nelson Goodman evoke any thoughts? Because he ran the summer school.
No, he didn't run it. He was on the board, and he got me on the board. Summer School of Arts, the Arts Administration School is what you're talking about.
Oh, he's not at Harvard. I just said, yeah.
Yes, he's at Harvard. He's a very, very famous professor of philosophy. His specialty is logics, and he wrote a book called The Language of Art, Languages of Art.
And
we worked with him, both because he got me on that board, and number two, we did a production with him. His wife was an artist, crippled, and she did sketches of hockey players off the television in Sumo ink, and we projected them in a theatrical piece called Hockey Scene, S-C-E-N-E, which we performed at Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania and in Belgium, in Nuka-en-Zuid, and on the philosophy camp. Not on Zoot, but it's the resort on the sea.
Okay.
And there was a philosophers conference there. At a casino, and we did several performances of the piece, and it was an interesting, really interesting production.
Now, when you're teaching at summer school, what's Michael Callahan doing? I mean, at Harvard, not summer school. At Harvard, what is Michael doing?
Well, it's at the same time that we're running intermediate.
Right.
I'm not teaching full-time. I'm just teaching a few classes a week, and some of them are actually taught in our facility at intermediate.
I see. When you say you're Nelson Goodman, he put you on the board. What is the board? What's the board of
the
what?
The board of the Summer School for Arts Administration.
And what did you do in that capacity, being on the board?
We, you know, guided the program. Eventually, Harvard canceled the whole school, which it was probably the most important and effective program in arts administration in the country. And they just decided that it wasn't worth their energy anymore. That was under the presidency of, I can't remember the guy's name. He shut down a lot of stuff at Harvard. Not very well liked.
The one that
that
was there for the student riots in 69? I've seen interviews with him.
Like, yeah, maybe.
Grayson Kirk, Clayton Kirk or some.
Yeah, right.
Some name like that. So, the thing is we're going to bring in another name who was someone you admired, and that's Ken Dewey. Now, Ken Dewey, he got you on the arts panels, the New York State Council of Art.
Yep.
Now, he was a performance poet, you said, a performance artist. Can you give me an example of what he did, what kind of work he did?
Yeah, he had a group called Action Theater. It was basically street theater or...
not like living theater?
No, not like living theater. Very different emphasis.
Would they just show up in public spaces?
And that was one of the modalities, but no, a lot of them were programmed works. They had to do with social phenomena. It was a very interesting... It came from Admiral Dewey's family.
Admiral Dewey?
Yeah, and he died in an airplane, his flying his own aircraft.
So is Ken your age?
Ken, I think, may have been maybe at my age, maybe a couple of years older. And we worked together, partially with Brockman, on a number of projects.
What is it about Ken that is remarkable? I mean, you talk about him in the Bancroft College interview as a very influential person, in a way, charismatic. Is he the one who organized the newer artists for getting grants through the New York State Council? Is he the one?
Well, he was very effective on the council, and he also started an organization of which, again, I was on the board, called Planning Corporation for the Arts. And, you know, it was a time under Governor Rockefeller when both statewide and nationwide arts funding was active and quite large. And it was before, I don't mean this necessarily pejoratively, but before the minorities took over those organizations.
Right. So the, would you, when you first get on these arts panels, is it 65, 66, is it before you're in Life magazine? Or
no.
At the time, once you get in Life magazine?
Maybe after.
Right, so that gives you a bit of charisma as an artist. I mean, you're really in demand at that point, 66, 67, in so many parts of society or New York life. You got the world happening. You've got the Bendels, or whatever that store is, and you've got your performances, your the video. Is there, let's go back into, you get your video camera. Do you make video for yourself, or do you incorporate it into USCO?
It wasn't incorporated into USCO. No, and I don't think it was involved with John Brockman and Ed Rosenfeld. And
you met Ed way back then.
Yeah. He was part of the. He and John and I were real time. I mean, I was just the video part of it, but they were the print.
Yeah, Ed comes back from hippie San Francisco, and he starts working with Quentin Fiore. And I think he works on The Medium as a Massage, or he saw that it came out before he meets Quentin Fiore or Jerome Angel, whichever one it was. And then he works on the Bucky Fuller books and maybe the Stanley Kubrick books.
And then, then he was editor of Omni.
Omni's more is in the middle 70s, but he works for Quentin Fiore in the late 60s. And maybe that's the period, real times happens in 70, 71, 72. If I had the books, I could look at the dates, but I remember it's the early 70s. And what's funny about the real-time books, it's an inventory of all kinds of information resources, but it has a picture of you in the back of the first issue. And it said, it's like Gerd Stern is available to go around and lecture at colleges and that. They were hoiking up you as the PR person for the real-time.
I forgot about that. I don't remember that.
You were the man for the real-time. I don't know if your picture's in the second issue, but it's in the first one. But that would be, and definitely I think that's when you were doing Intermedia. So Brockman and Ed, they somehow meet in that period. And then you meet them. So you made
Brockman met Marshall through me at some point.
Right. Oh, I was wondering, I've talked to Brockman a couple times, and he did the book by the late John Brockman in 69, and it was done on a weekend in a home up on the Cape. It occurred to me, reading through the Bancroft history, it might have been the home that you mentioned that you guys would go.
It wasn't a home, it was a motel. I was in the room next door, and John was bitched because we were making too much noise making love.
Who's we? I mean, is it Judy or Sally?
It's Sally.
Right. But, okay, because there was a house, somebody's place, up in the Providence or that area that you guys could retreat to.
No, it was not a home. I mean, there was a home that I could retreat to, but it had nothing to do with Brockman, which was Paul Williams' A-frame.
Right, that's what it was, yeah.
But that's a different period. That place is still there. His ex-wife, Betsy, lives there in Wellfleet. But when John and I were supposed to be writing a media book.
Oh, you were supposed to be? That's where that book came from? The book by the late John Brockman was originally a joint project?